You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our elevators are only for white people. Wait, no, I said aren't. Aren't only for... forget it. Joining me this trip, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, you must be really excited for the convention this week, and I don't mean Comic-Con.
Oh yeah, I am all a Twitter about Republicans in Cleveland. Mostly I'm excited because the politicians on the right have left D.C., and thus there's less traffic. So I really like that part of the convention.
Yeah, you can actually get on the metro this week, right?
Well, no, the metro is shut down, but for repairs. I'm not even joking. Like, my stop and the stops around me are closed for repairs. So that doesn't benefit me there, but there's less traffic, so I can get an Uber in. But what doesn't excite me about the convention is the nonsense that went on today. I'm not going to explain it. Let's just say that if Donald Trump runs his convention like he plans to run the country, there won't even be a pretense of the rule of law. He will just say what I say goes, because I am the law.
Yeah, I mean, isn't a vote for Trump a vote for Trumpism? And that's just like Donald Trump does whatever he wants. I mean, we all saw The Celebrity Apprentice, or I did, where he would fire people for random reasons. That's what I expect a Trump presidency to be like.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So, hashtag, what is it? If you want to see the nonsense going on, it's hashtag RNC in CLE, and it comes up with an adorable little red elephant. So, check that out on Twitter. It's nonsense.
And still the second worst thing to happen in Cleveland this year, the first being them actually winning a championship.
Zing.
I just hate LeBron James. Also joining us this trip via Skype from the Bay in the South, Midsider William Green. Welcome back to the show, William.
Glad to be back. It's been a great week, great couple weeks since we've hung out, but I think the last time we all hung out together was the wedding. So
yeah, in the Gulch, we all last hung out.
Yeah, so that was awesome. Had a good landing on Sunday night and Monday morning, depending on where in the United States you lived. And so things are flying high out here in the birthplace of rockets.
Yeah, he was referring to the spaceship landing, not like the airplane landing. We didn't just get back from Austin on Sunday night. It was a great couple.
Post-bachelor party?
Yeah.
You sound like Ben Affleck and Tom Brady going to Vegas with the nanny. It has been a great couple of weeks, though, because we had a lot to talk about last episode, and we have a lot to talk about this episode, too. So why don't we get right into it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, it may have been a great week, Justin, but not for the fine folks in France. So, awkward segue. Nice attack, 84 people killed. So, thank you for that setup, Justin. Much appreciated.
I'm just so culturally insensitive. They're French people. Who cares?
The other French people care. And, yeah, so this is not news. Like, people understand that this happened a bit ago. For anyone who's unfamiliar, you should go to the internet at some point in your life. But here's sort of the newsy thing that has come out recently, which is that it was actually a crowd goer at the Bastille Day celebration where this Muslim man killed 84 people using a truck who stopped the rampage basically by jumping into the cab of the truck and seizing the revolver from the attacker. I did not know this. This is something that Justin gave to me in the news section.
And something well, that no, I had which no is idea. A, fir- that's a first, by the way.
I didn't hear this anywhere. Did either of you hear this talked about? Like,
no,
I've heard
no.
every angle, except that that some random dude in the crowd who they don't name, I guess maybe they're trying to protect his identity.
They're trying to protect him from all the pussy he can get. They just don't want him to die by fucking.
Exactly. He jumped into the cab of the truck and wrestled with the driver. And then the driver seized the revolver and fired several shots at the man and at the police who were on the scene, but no one was hurt. The driver was then shot dead by two officers. So, holy crap, if there's sort of any at all minute bit of gleaming hope for humanity that comes out of this story, it's that there are still people who are willing to take action in these scenarios when they realize not only that their life is in risk, but the lives of their loved ones are at risk. By the way, don't think this is an altruistic act at all. I think this guy was acting selfishly, and it may have helped save dozens of more people. Police say that the truck driver, by the way, who went for 2 kilometers, which is any number of miles, I have no idea. But it could have gone much longer because the guy was not running out of steam in any way if this stranger had not jumped into the cab of the truck. So, my goodness, hero.
And what does it say about the news, too? Like, this seems like the most important fact about this attack.
Yes.
You know, that people are actually, you know, usually it's the French and surrendering is usually the storyline. So maybe it just doesn't fit that narrative, but all joking aside, it doesn't fit the narrative, right? Like someone actually standing up for themselves and their loved ones and their community. It doesn't fit that narrative of we're all just helpless in the face of this terrorism.
No, the most important fact about this story is this has nothing to do with radical Islam. Do not look at the terrorists behind the curtain. That is the most important part about this story.
Yes, indeed. Justin making a glib but very important point here, which is the people are still baffled by his motives. And the whole idea of motives, especially in the recent attacks, has become almost a point of Monty Python-esque hilarity, where now the police have to come out after every single one of these things and say, oh, we have no idea what his motives are. We've done an investigation. Can't tell what his motives are.
And are you saying the police in the Orlando attack came out and said that? They came out?
Hilarious. Obama said we may never know what his motive was. But yes, the police, by the way, in a bit of an addendum story to this, the FBI has found no evidence that Orlando shooter targeted Pulse because it was a gay club.
Except for the fact that it was a gay club. I mean, he could have attacked any other club, but he picked the gay club. I mean, isn't that evidence enough? Like, isn't that like a conscious thing? Like, wouldn't it have been easier for him to attack other clubs?
I mean, I guess we could do a quick experiment. If you just look for like the top rated club in Orlando, like gay or straight, is it near the top? Because maybe just randomly he could pick it. But like even that seems a little far fetched to me.
Isn't the top rated club in Orlando Disney World?
The family vacation club.
Yeah, you gotta pay to get in.
Yeah, the beach club.
It is pretty, racy there sometimes, yeah. Especially when they have the gay days. But
I really, this article kind of is infuriating because you've got sort of, they try to present two sides and both sides are just fundamentally wrong. You know, you have people saying, you know, the FBI saying they can't find any evidence of this guy targeting gay. The gay club Pulse, and not just, you know, a random club. And then you have some eyewitnesses that claim they've seen him on dating apps and stuff like that, which it would be harder to figure that stuff out if someone is seriously closeted and hiding those sort of things. But yeah, put all that aside, then you have the LGBT protesters at the end saying that this wasn't a crime against Americans or a crime of gun violence. This was a crime against gays. And that's also wrong. That idea that it was just it doesn't matter so much if he targeted who he targeted, but the why that connects back to Islam, that's the important part. That's the part we cannot talk about in the news story, right? No one wants to connect or are afraid to connect those dots and say, well, of course, a Islamic terrorist is going to target something that they find reprehensible and they find that gays are alive to be reprehensible, so they are going to target them. It's an inference that doesn't require a whole lot of evidence from his phone, which is what they discussed in the article. Like what was on his phone? You can look at all the things that all of these clerics write about, especially the one that he follows.
Yeah.
Wait. So William, and what you just said, did those gays just admit that gays aren't American? Because that's what I just heard.
I reading that last paragraph of the article, it like I said, it's just very infuriating to say. It's the politics of dividing into ever smaller, but not to the level of an individual subgroups, and that intergroup warfare of, well, we're, you know, these LGBT protesters are clearly trying to take back the we're the most oppressed minority label from whoever owns it right now.
Right, because an attack on gays is an attack on Americans if they live in America, because that's a subset of Americans. I thought you guys wanted to be included. What the fuck? I can ostracize you again.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, when we talk about different groups being targeted by Islamic terrorism, it's important to remember that the thing that unites all of us against all of them, all of the Islamic terrorism, is our ideas, our separation of church and state. That's the thing that they decry the most. That we don't have our government be holy, that we recognize a rational basis for our rights, and that our rights are not granted to us from the government, and we're not our primary concern is not the life in the hereafter, but how to organize the life that we have here in front of us, and that's the thing that unites us, that American idea, and that's what they're fighting against.
Amen, brother. Well,
can I make a glib but unimportant point before we move on?
Sure.
It is your show.
So I know it's pronounced Nice, but I would really prefer if they would write the attack on Nice instead of the Nice attack, because written out it looks like the Nice attack, which is very confusing, and it made me look up some other town names that if these towns were attacked it would be very confusing. There's Lovely, Kentucky, so you'd have the Lovely attack. Friendly, West Virginia, the Friendly attack. Or Best, Texas, or Ideal, Georgia. Then there's Dinosaur, Colorado, so you'd have the Dinosaur attack. Or Arizona, there's Bumblebee, Arizona, so you'd have the Bumblebee attack. Or my personal favorite, Cheesequake, New Jersey. So, if there was a terrorist attack in Cheesequake, New Jersey, the headlines will read, "The Cheesequake Attack."
Nice.
Did we really just spend time on that?
I'm just saying, look at your headlines, people. The Nice attack looks like the Nice attack. And that it was not a very nice attack.
You know what else isn't very nice? According to Vox. I mean, other than everything.
What this week Pokemon, is the question.
Pokemon Go. Timothy B. Lee writes that Pokemon Go is everything that is wrong with late capitalism.
Can I ask a question?
I swear to God, you could just put the Onion's byline up at the top of this, and it would have it reads like an Onion article. It is absolutely hilarious.
That's very true. Yeah. And I have a question that's relevant to this. So it's not irrelevant this time. Did you know there's a town called Pokemon... No, I'm just kidding. What is the difference between late capitalism and regular capitalism? Is that like when you do all your payments not on time? Like you miss the due date for all your credit card payments? Like, I've never heard of late capitalism before.
I don't know what it is.
I can give you a little insight. So it's a neo-Marxist...
all right, that's it. All right, I need to hear
more. They mean capitalism after 1945.
So it is. It's the capitalism that showed up late in American history. Yes. It's sort of like it didn't really, before when we were doing everything, it wasn't around, and it just kind of showed up during the civil rights era. It was like, hey, guys, we're capitalism more.
Wait till you see this horrible game we're going to produce in like 60 years. Okay. So here's how the article begins, and I want to read the beginning, not because it's interesting, but because it makes no sense, and then it goes on to have
because
no
that's
connection.
What this show is all about. Things that are not interesting and make
and then it goes on to not have any relevance to the rest of the article, which is why I'm reading it to you. Last week, two things happened that will have long-lasting impact on American society and the global economy. First, the yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to a record low of 1.366%. Second, Nintendo released Pokemon Go, a mobile game that in a matter of days has become a viral sensation. And then he goes on to say, these two developments are more closely connected than it might seem at first, but he never makes the connection.
Yeah, I didn't understand that transition either. I was like, you're just following a formula at this point, writing-wise.
Yeah, so the crux of this article, I'm not going to quote much more, but the crux of this article is that Pokemon Go represents a form of capitalism wherein people are not spending money in the local economies where they live. They're not thinking global, buying local. But they are instead sending a bunch of money to a huge Japanese conglomerate, and that's a horrible thing. It basically ends by saying the government needs to solve this problem by making housing more affordable and in high-tech areas so people can move to where the jobs are. Brr, 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 brr. This is the most ridiculous nonsense shit Vox has put out in quite a while, in my opinion. So what say you? Are nerds giving too much money to Japanese conglomerates and not enough money to their local shoemaker and horse whip manufacturer?
You know, I looked really quick, on my motorcycle ride back from work, and there were no vintage Craftsman game makers, video game makers anywhere between SpaceX and here. I mean, there was Riot Games, but you know that I think that would be considered a big multinational, a post-capitalist company. So I don't think.
Did
that
you go up to Santa Monica on the way down to where you live? Riots like not in between your work and your home.
I had to go to the Apple Store. So yes.
Oh, okay. Fair
there
enough.
You go.
Fair point.
So you didn't stop in at your artisanal game design shop.
I did not.
Aren't those all in Brooklyn?
Locally sourced programmers.
Locally sourced code. That's what I really want to see. Locally sourced code. Nothing but free-range organic coders.
Aren't all coders bought on the internet from, like, Eastern Europe or India? That's what I learned from Silicon Valley.
Yeah. I still haven't seen that show, and people keep recommending it to me.
I like it.
I think it decreases my nerd cred that I haven't actually seen a single episode of that.
But I mean, based upon our last news story here, isn't it bad to be sending any money to Japan at this point?
Well, spoilers.
But I mean, this is another question. They're really reaching here, aren't they? And the reason
what?
I think they're reaching aren't there
what?
Other reasons? Aren't there other reasons to hate Pokemon Go? Or are there no reasons to hate Pokemon Go that they had to reach to this level? Because I'm seeing there's some backlash, and people are like, why are you getting mad? It's making people social, and it's making them exercise.
It's making them walk out into traffic. These are all things that I appreciate.
Darwin, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But here's even the stupid part about this article, is they couldn't wait a week to write it to find out like what effects Pokemon Go would actually have on the local economy. Pokemon Go has actually been incredibly great for local economies.
Right, because they can buy those lures, which bring people into the store. So a lure basically makes it so more Pokemon are in your area, and you can get those for like $1 to $5 an hour or something like that. You put that in your store, and then all of a sudden all these kids and various people are coming into your stores, and they're buying things while they're also looking for Pokemon. So if one person buys two candy bars in that hour, you've already made your investment back, plus increased the foot traffic in your store tremendously.
Yeah, it's been tremendous for local economies. So this past weekend, Fize and I went to Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is not some metropolis. It's a little town, consists of about three blocks of things, and it's mostly sleepy and old people, and we stayed at a bed and breakfast. It was delightful. So then we go out on Friday night just for a walk, like 10 o'clock, and there are hundreds of people out roaming the streets. And it took us about a half hour because we were wildly confused as why hundreds of people were roaming around this sleepy town, all literally 100% of them were playing Pokemon Go. And businesses were staying open late to accommodate them. So we got to enjoy the benefit of other people playing Pokemon Go by going into bars and restaurants that were staying open late specifically to cater to nerds. This has been fantastic for local economies.
I think this whole article is just clickbait. This is the very thing that they are railing against here in just completely absurd clickbaity article.
That's all internet journalism nowadays is the instant anything becomes a trending topic, a buzzword, people have to write an article with it in the title, no matter what the article says, just to get people to click on their site. That's the entirety of the internet news cycle.
So when is the next the Midside blog article title involving Pokemon Go coming out? That's what I want to know.
Not happening.
Yeah, we're not good at that.
We don't do that. We do real count.
You know what else we're not good at? And by we, I mean California, apparently. Educating students about LGBT history. So apparently that's going to be a thing now. In second grade, this is the article. In second grade, California students will learn about families with two moms or two dads. 2 years later, while studying how immigrants have shaped the Golden State, they will hear how New York native Harvey Milk became a pioneering gay politician in San Francisco. The State Board unanimously approved those changes in classroom instruction Thursday to comply with the nation's first law requiring public schools to include prominent gay Americans and LGBT rights milestones in history classes. So, good, bad, neither? Should we be teaching more about the gays?
I'm waiting for them to pass the law where they're going to actually mandate that they teach reading and writing. I'm hoping that will be next.
Pretty controversial, William.
Yeah. Well,
don't get me started on that subject.
Especially what I said in English. That would be extremely controversial. I think this is stupid. You can't live in today's culture and not see some of these things. The gays, we're out there. I don't think you need a special class. It's not like talking to a gay. You need some sort of language and culture class in order to bridge some sort of cultural gap. I don't think that's true in today's society. I mean, there's some things that are unique, but you can just kind of, when you get 21, just go with one of your friends to the gay bar, and you can, if you really want to see what the culture is like, you can go there, go to the Pride Parade.
But this is part of the overarching agenda to tear down normalcy in America. And what I mean by that is, I mean, the heteronormative is the way they call it. So they're just trying to promote alternative histories to make it seem like, there was more going on in history than there was. And I'm not saying there isn't a history of gay people in America and in California. I'm just saying they're trying to rewrite it because based upon the idea of history goes to the victors. So this is their way of trying to change kids' minds to try and change the culture. That's all it is.
Yeah, and it also says something about who they picked, right? They pick, a politician. Why not a businessman? Or a military member. Like, there's lots of great stories about people who served our country proudly during Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and those would be great stories to learn.
Or gay for pay porn star.
Or gay for pay porn star. You can learn all that.
Why don't we just put William Shakespeare back in the curriculum?
Because they should never, if they want to teach English, they should never teach Shakespeare.
Ooh. So here are a couple of my favorite quotes from this article, by the way, which cannot go without being read. Allison Chu, who just finished 11th grade at Cupertino High School, spoke in favor of how the guidelines address gay issues. Quote, "My classmates can solve quadratic equations or cite the elements on the periodic table. They can't tell you who Harvey Milk was or the significance of the Stonewall riots." Good! Fucking good! If more people could solve quadratic equations and cite the periods of the elements of the periodic table, we wouldn't be in a fucking mess that we're in. I'm glad they can't tell you who Harvey Milk was, because they should be focused more on quadratic equations and more on reading and writing and less on this nonsense stuff that if you wanted to, you could get from your parents. And if your parents wanted to teach you about these things, fantastic. Or guess what? If you personally wanted to look these things up, you can go to this magical box that's in every home now that contains all the information ever in the whole world. And we can allow teachers to focus on teaching core subjects, reading, writing, math, literature, history, and not focus on the social justice stuff.
Yeah, this stuff is way out of context for anybody in elementary school, junior high, even high school. Like, understanding these kinds of like issues, like just the politics of like and the history around, you know, even like something like Harvey Milk or the riots, like you're not going to have the kind of basic building blocks of knowledge in order to even like understand or interpret it. And how will it be taught? It will be taught, just like you said, Daniel, in a social justice way. It'll be, you know, I can only imagine the curriculum being something like, well, how do black people feel about the Harvey Milk election or something like that? You know, like it would be so intersected. Is that a verb? So that we, you know, it would just be all a disintegrated mess. Like no one would understand what's the context and why this was important. And other than, well, it's just another thing that we have to learn. It's another fact I have to have.
Let's make a rule. Yeah. Anything that's on James Franco's filmography should not be taught in school.
Takes out quite a bit. All right. Well, speaking of things that should be taught in schools, Japan this week, if you're going to do a little pop culture in your school classroom, current events, Japan decided to be fascist this week.
Just like that. Just
all of a sudden.
Yeah. Snap their fingers. We're fascist now.
Kinda. Really, this week, Japan's Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partners won a 2/3 majority in the legislature's upper house to go along with their 2/3 majority in the lower house. A 2/3 majority is required in each house to begin the process of amending Japan's constitution, and amending the constitution is one of the central planks of the Liberal Democratic Party's platform. For anyone who doesn't know or doesn't remember in history, the Constitution was imposed on Japan by the United States after the Second World War, and it has never been amended. As Bloomberg reports, the LDP has pointed out that, quote, several of the current constitutional provisions are based on the Western European theory of natural human rights. Such provisions, therefore, need to be changed. So what does the LDP have against Western European theory of natural rights? Well, just you wait and see. The LDP is one of these parties in Japan that believes that Japan has nothing to apologize for from World War II, for instance, that everything they did was perfectly reasonable, and that they shouldn't apologize for bombing Pearl Harbor or using comfort women or any of the things that the West has denounced. And in fact, the Liberal Democratic Party wants to crack down, for instance, on First Amendment rights. That's really funny. Well, we would consider First Amendment rights, free speech rights, basically saying that if there is speech that harms the national interest, it can be forced down. If there's speech that goes against the state and what the state is doing, and it's a mess over there right now. So here's the basic crux of this story. There's nowhere where liberty is winning, gentlemen. Nowhere. It's receding and receding fast.
For me, this is the most horrific story we've done on the 4 years we've done the podcast. To me, this is like the signal of a coming dark ages. Like, they're rejecting natural rights, and they're denying that, like, prostituting all of those Chinese women and the other women in the war, during the war, is fine, that they didn't do anything wrong. They're going to worship an emperor again. It's like completely going backwards. This is like, I don't even think there's anything to really joke about here. This is just awful.
Yeah, it is pretty awful. By the way, yeah, speaking of the emperor thing, I do want to flesh that out a little bit. They list these certain obligations that people have, by the way, in their new version of the Constitution that they want to pass. Like, the people must be conscious of the fact that they are responsible. Their responsibilities and obligations in compensation for freedom and rights. These obligations include they must uphold the Constitution, respect the national anthem. They must comply with public interest and public order. And people must obey commands from the state in times of quote-unquote emergency. Except the emperor is exempt from the regulations to uphold the Constitution. The emperor is required under the new Constitution to seek advice from the cabinet, but not, as he is currently required, to seek advice and approval from the current cabinet. So they absolutely unequivocally want to go back to an imperial system.
Yeah, this is particularly scary because of Japanese history. The culture, there is a cultural element. You know, we talk about the so-called, you know, history of racism in America, but America overthrew racism, and you know, here in the West especially, you know, we sort of led that effort. And Great Britain obviously played a huge role with their navy. But in Japan, they skipped a stage of development during the Meiji Restoration, a stage of cultural development. And they there are parts of Japanese culture that are still alive today that feel that the Japanese race are a superior race and that they should rule the world. That is what they think. And that non-Japanese are non-people in a very important way, and especially when it comes to some of their neighbors. It's a very racist, very collectivist. And that was, if you look back at some of the writing, you know, why we imposed the particular constitution that we did impose on Japan during the occupation was exactly because we needed to separate out this idea of church and state. And in this case, the church here is an imperial religion called Shinto. You do see there is a resurgence of Shinto in Japan. There is this resurgence of political power in this. Japan's basically had a one-party system for a while, and a lot of their a lot of the like proximate cause to a lot of the issues in Japan is their very their banking and monetary system has suffered through the 80s and the 90s, even today, through kind of adopting a more European style of fiscal involvement, so definitely not a free economic system. And so there is kind of a discontentment with the way things are. And unfortunately, because of this unclear thinking and this sort of collectivism and religious pieces of their culture, instead of appealing to a sense of life like we have in America, where we can appeal to that individualism and that understanding of inalienable rights, that sort of sense of life. In Japan, that sense of life is not there. And so when you appeal to and I'm painting with a broad stroke here, when you appeal to a general sense of life in Japan, it is this sort of feeling of superiority and this feeling of being the master race. And that is particularly scary.
Well, damn. Hot damn, in fact. I didn't know we had an expert in Japanese history and culture.
I mean, it just shows that South Park got it right, didn't it? I mean, they're overcompensating for their tiny penis.
Yeah, that's basically what William said.
That's what I heard. I heard, at least. Yeah. And I mean,
my survey of Japanese penises is not complete, but I'll let you know when it is.
All right, so William will be taking a trip to Japan soon. Just be on the lookout for that, anyone in Japan. This also is just like, fuck you whale, fuck you dolphin, isn't it?
I don't know.
Excuse me?
Have you not seen that episode of South Park? Fuck Maybe. You, whale! Fuck you, dolphin!
I don't remember that nope. bit. Oh, I do. Okay. I just remember Shu.
Yeah.
And Chimpokomon.
But, I mean, in all seriousness, isn't this... We celebrated Brexit a while ago. Isn't this the complete opposite of Brexit?
Yeah, but, I mean, like, now even, like... Oh, this, I mean, yes. Unequivocally, before I move on and shit on your point, just kidding. But yes, this is the complete opposite of Brexit. But even Brexit now is being tamped down. Like, there's a new prime minister in Britain who's like, yeah, Brexit, we'll get to it sometime in like 2019. Just relax. Like, we're not going anywhere.
Okay, you knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Even Brexit, we're just sort of like, eh.
Well, they're just going to keep, in Britain, they're just going to keep holding a vote until they get the vote they want. I mean, that's the European Union's main method of getting anything passed. They just keep holding a vote until they get the outcome they want. But I think another kind of like prism to think going forward, not to turn this to the election, but of the two major candidates, and even throw the Libertarian Party candidate in there too, Gary Johnson, do you think any of them would be able to do anything to help out with this Japanese problem? I think the answer is pretty clearly no, right?
No.
The Libertarians are isolationists. Trump, well, I don't. What is he gonna, he'll make a deal.
All
with
you have to do is say his name, and we know it's not going to work out.
And then Hillary, I mean, she'll just sell. You know, she'll just sell some sort of something to them for future campaign donations to the Clinton Library and Massage Parlor.
I mean, to be fair, look, there is the off chance that Trump might drop another nuclear bomb on them, which would have some sort of comedic value, if not for the life of the loss of human life.
Can you see Trump responding to this, though? Look, they get uppity, we'll bomb them. We did it once, twice, we'll do it again. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Night time if we need to. We'll just drop a bomb, it's fine.
Yeah.
We've got great bombs. We have the best bombs.
It's like Trump is that Dennis Leary song, Asshole. You know why? Because we've got the bombs!
He's an asshole. Yeah, got it.
Alright, we want to move on to other things that assholes made?
Mm-hmm.
It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Before we go into our reviews, I want to address a listener comment. So on our last podcast, a listener left a comment that I think is important for us to address because it really shows the difference between Marvel and DC, and more specifically the film Snyder is making versus what's out there in the culture with the way we tell stories. So this comment was left by someone named Doug, D-U-G. I think his brother's name might be Dig. This is what he said. Talking about Avengers, I didn't see Iron Man's actions at the end of the Avengers as self-sacrifice. Did you miss the phone call he made prior to his climactic heroic act? He called Pepper Potts because she is what mattered most to him, and he could not live without her. His act was selfish and in accord with his highest value. He was a hero in the most Randian sense. Now, I sent you guys the link to the scene. It's actually on YouTube. If anyone wants to check it out, I'll also include it in our, you know, the outline we have on our page here. What do you guys think? Do you guys have a response to this? I do, but I would like to go last, so.
You would like to go last? Well, of course, you get to have the last word.
What is my segment of my show, so?
Oh, man.
It's the most you. So this is sort of my thought about it. When I saw it in the theater initially, my thought was less sort of sacrifice, more along the lines of what Doug was saying. But the more I see it and the more I intellectualize it, it doesn't fit into the overarching story. It doesn't fit, especially when you consider the next movies that come with Iron Man being basically becoming the bad guy. It doesn't fit into the Marvel Cinematic Universe for it not to be a sacrificial act. They need him to sacrifice so that he loses his ego, because that is the number one bad thing about Tony Stark in the Marvel world, is his ego. So he has to, if Joss Whedon could have killed off the character, he would have, because that would have been the only way for Tony Stark to have true penance for his ego. That's just sort of a very quick and dirty take on it. But
yeah, I think, we're clearly here talking about the movie universe, the Marvel movie universe. But yeah, the Iron Man character, at least the way in Whedon presents it, the ego is the flaw here, not the sort of, more like in the first two Iron Mans, where the flaw is not necessarily his ego, it's his, you know, his sort of disconnection to reality, his sort of over the top behaviors. It's not connecting his values properly, but that all gets lost in the later movies. Like it's all about how he needs to be cut down a notch. And yeah, I think I agree with you, Daniel. That's a good insight. If Joss could have killed him, he would have killed him there. And that would have been the only way to redeem him, is for him to have no value.
And for a 15-year-old African-American girl to take over.
Yep.
I mean, I would like to first make the point that I believe Daniel got the point of Whedon would have killing him if he could from me.
Oh, who knows where these things come from.
I'm pretty sure I said that. Because, in fact, you do think Iron Man is dead. He lays there on the ground for, like, 30 seconds, and all the other Avengers think he's dead. And by the way, rewatching this scene, did anyone else notice that Hulk just destroys buildings when he jumps all over the place? Nobody seems to give a shit about that, but that's a tangential point. So I want to address the specific point that Doug made here about him calling Pepper Potts. And I want to contrast this with the way Superman talks to Lois in Batman vs. Superman right before he dies. And you have to look at the dialogue. So the dialogue in Avengers is Jarvis saying to Tony Stark, "Should I try Miss Potts?" And then Stark replies, "Might as well." Does that sound like someone who that's the person he's fighting for and that's why he's about to sacrifice his life? "Oh, you might as well call her. You know, I'm going to die, so you might as well call my highest value."
It's actually a very important nuanced point that I didn't quite catch that you point out, which is that it's not even that. So like Doug says that Tony Stark calls Pepper Potts as his highest value. That's not true.
No, Jarvis suggests it.
Jarvis makes the suggestion and he goes along with it.
Right.
And as an artistic choice, that's actually a pretty profound difference.
Right, because artistically it's saying right before he dies, he's not even thinking about who he loves. He's still only thinking about whatever. That you don't even really know what he's thinking at that point.
Yeah, you have no idea what's going on inside. I haven't seen this movie. I know enough about the plot, though, to know where this fits in. But you have no idea what the motivation is really, other than the action sequence. There's nothing. There's no insight. That would have been a perfect point to put what is he thinking here at this particular juncture. Instead, it's what we think the AI is thinking. That's the only thing we know is that Jarvis is concerned for Pepper, not that that Iron Man is.
Well, right. Jarvis is trying to anticipate Tony's needs, and he's doing it in a more human way than Tony is doing it. And contrast that with, as William's saying, looking in a hero's head, and look at the way Goyer, Terrio, and Snyder handled Superman right before he goes in and gets killed by Doomsday. What does he say to Lois? Where Lois looks at him and is like, "No, don't do that." And he looks at Lois and he basically says, "I'm doing this for you." When he says, "This is my world. You are my world." Look at the difference in those statements. One, "might as well." The second one, the repetition of the word "my," the repetition of "my world," which was a theme throughout the movie, and the repetition of Lois looking her in the eyes and loving her like he had the entire movie. One is clearly an assertion of his values and saying that's what he's fighting for, and the other, as William pointed out, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, imagine the vast difference in the scene if one, Tony had initiated, but even if he hadn't done the call thing, if he just said, like, you know, "Bring up that picture of Pepper," or whatever, and there was, like, some image or some movie that plays in his helmet that he's watching while he's doing this or whatever. Like, you could have massively changed the message of that scene by having him initiate something to do with Pepper, when in fact, I think it's very clear that this is supposed to be a sacrifice.
Right, and you could have made it a tearjerker. Can you imagine him calling Pepper, "Pepper, I just want you to know I'm holding on to a nuclear bomb right now that I'm going to detonate in space." "What, Tony? There's no other way to do it?" And then she stays on the phone with him while he goes through space, and she loses the connection with him when it explodes. "Tony, are you there, Tony?" As he falls to the ground, you hear Pepper, the distress in her voice. I'm writing a script right now, but you get the point, right?
Man, I got a little choked up there.
I'm seriously, my eyes are watering thinking about it.
Fuck you, Joss.
That's much more nonsense. Yeah, it's much more dramatic in that way. And that's the thing. You have to think about it, a brief screenwriting thing before we move on to reviews. You have to think about it. What would make your themes the most dramatic? And that would make it more dramatic. And if you want to do the self-sacrifice, Jarvis forcing him to talk to Pepper and forcing Pepper to hear that would have even been more dramatic than the way it was executed.
Yeah.
Instead, she just doesn't pick up the phone, and you're like, "Well, that sucks." Okay, but Avengers still was pretty good. So let's review some things that maybe we didn't like as much as Avengers. Let's start with you, Daniel. You said you saw The Secret Life of Pets.
I did. Secret Life of Pets, smash hit here for Illumination Entertainment, the same group that did Minions and that stuff.
Despicable Me was what you were looking for.
Well, they did Minions. The movie Minions. Yeah,
they did do that.
Justin.
Yeah, it just looked like you were trying. It sounded like you were trying to say something else, so I was giving you something else.
Oh, well, there you go. Thank you. Indeed.
Yeah.
So, Secret Life of Pets, lots of good voices in this. Louis C.K. and Dana Carvey and Albert Brooks.
Eric Stone Street from Modern Family.
Yeah, a lot of great voices. Kevin Hart actually plays an adorable little rabbit who's a psychotic murderer, which is a cute part for him. Here's the thing, did very well. Rightfully so, I think. It's a good kids movie in a certain sense. It's entertaining, and it's a solid sort of C movie. And in my rating scale, like one for movies, like one is the F and 10 is the perfect A. And so this is sort of like a solid 5. But here's the thing that disappointed me about it, especially as children's movies are getting so good, especially integrating plot and theme and character development. This movie didn't have much of that at all. This is basically a movie where they have a very, very rough plot. I don't know. God, it's hard for me to even call it a plot.
Rough plot?
Yes. Yes, a rough plot. It's hard for me to even call it a plot, though, because it's more just a series of events. It's basically a dog likes his home. A new dog gets introduced. He doesn't like it. He tries to get rid of him. It doesn't work out. They learn to be friends. But that's even being really generous about themes. There's really no theme to this movie. It's just a series of events that happen, a series of scenes that are funny, and it's shockingly a lot of just sort of physical bashing around, falling comedy. A lot of visual sight gag comedy.
So it's slapstick.
It's a lot of slapstick and some good writing, but there's really no integrating theme. There's no character development, really. So for the most part, it's not up to the level of even Finding Dory, which I also saw, which I think is a solid 8.
What number do you give Pets?
Pets, 5.
Okay. You said C, yeah. So.
C, for me, right in the middle.
Okay.
Is a C. And Finding Dory, you know, not one of Pixar's best, but still just outstanding in terms of theme, I think, and story and character development. But here's one thing that I'll say about Pets. The animation is completely amazing, especially the animation of the cities. Like, this is the first, other than like Ratatouille, it's one of the few animations that takes on huge cityscapes, and this one is New York City. And it does this stylization of New York City that is gorgeous. It looks like Art Deco painting almost. So if for nothing else, just go and put earplugs in and just watch the animation. It's quite beautiful, sort of shockingly beautiful at points.
Sort of like Kevin Hart's stand-up. Just go and put your earplugs in and watch his machinations.
His shockingly beautiful machinations.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that, for a while there, it started with Toy Story. We had the animation was important and it was outstanding and it was it had reached that threshold where you could just completely get immersed in it, but they really had to focus on the story and the characters in order to make it a good movie. And I'm hoping this isn't a trend, because you see now with the way a lot of CG movies are, not to transition to our next review, but you see how movies are made now, how action and comedy movies are made now, and it's all just the popcorn effects. You know, it's all effects and no story and plot, because you can kind of get away with it if you make enough flashy bright lights on the screen, if you make enough beautiful objects to look at, then yeah, people will go see it.
Well, that's a greater debate that maybe I'm going to write a piece on, or we can talk about in a later episode. And it's definitionally what makes a movie. Because can a movie just be a series of flashing lights and explosions, and that can be considered quote-unquote a movie if people are entertained by it? Or is there something else that's essentially a movie? I think that's an interesting question. I don't think we have time to answer that in this episode, but I think you raised something very important, William.
Why, thank you. That's why you let me come on the show sometimes.
Yeah, we're glad to have you as a midsider for that reason. Do we want to talk about the next movie?
Let's do it.
Go right ahead.
So, for you other midsiders out there, I fell on my sword, and I saw the new Ghostbusters movie. I didn't see it.
That website again, if you want to help fund the inevitable psychological corrections that will need to be made to psychotherapy.
Yeah, I'm going to have to add a few more sessions on. So if you want to give my therapist more money, it's at...
Patreon.com/doctor. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say it, William. Yeah, it's, if you want to go to Patreon and give my therapist more money, then go ahead. Patreon.com/themidside. So I didn't just see it to help you guys out. I also saw it because I wanted to be able to comment on it because of all the controversy around it. And what I have to say about it is this. This is literally one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I am not even exaggerating when I say this.
Don't hold back.
It was like an SNL skit stretched out over the runtime of an hour and 40 minutes. There was no there was basically no plot. The villain pops up randomly. The first time he pops up, I was like, is that really the villain? There's got to be somebody else behind him. No, that was him. Then randomly they turn Chris Hemsworth into the villain for a little bit. The characters have no motivations and no characteristics. There's like maybe one funny joke in the entire movie. And then this was the worst atrocity of all. In the original Ghostbusters, was there an action scene?
Yeah, at the very end, I would say yes, sort of.
But no, I'm talking like, is there hand-to-hand combat where they're fighting ghosts? No. Like ninja style and using weapons, such as grenades and hand pistols?
No.
Okay. In Central Park, in the pre-climax of this movie, I say pre-climax because then they go and fight the villain, they are in, not Central Park, in Times Square. In Times Square, they are fighting ghosts with their proton weapons. Like a full-on action scene. So if you've ever wanted to see Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig in an action scene, this is the movie for you. It only resembles Ghostbusters in name only, and it's not a good movie. It's not.
Yeah.
I give this movie a 2.5 out of 10 simply because it is a movie that they spent $144 million on.
So I've been following this movie closely because I'm a huge fan of the first movie Ghostbusters. And in honor of...
Oh, that reminds me. But continue.
I was going to say, in preparation, as show prep for this episode, I did rewatch it last night. And, man, does it still stand up. I mean, there's some of the effects are a little cheesy, and there's a couple things that miss now. But one of the you talk about the four main characters in the original Ghostbusters, but really the city is kind of like the fifth main character. New York City is a huge part of this movie, and I grew up in the Midwest. I had never even seen New York City until I was well into my 20s, and this was New York City to me. I remember walking around New York City when I first visited, looking for the buildings that you saw in Ghostbusters. That was it to me. And there's sort of, I know that fans aren't going to like this movie just because of the way it's made and the sort of total disregard for any of the elements that made it a good movie. But I wanted to, I watched the previews. I've heard people comment on the previews and then comment on the movie. And the biggest thing for me is this is another example of the sort of like all the effects being the important part and not really the story. Like there's some genuinely scary parts in Ghostbusters, not because the effects are particularly awesome, but just, you know, because of the way that they're shot and the way the it fits into the.
Hello?
Continue. Hello? Continue.
That's it. That's all I had.
Oh, it sounded like Ultron was taking over in the background there or something.
I thought Siri was weighing in.
Yeah, Ultron. You reminded me of something. So one of the things about the original Ghostbusters is that they're businessmen, right? That there's a need in the market for someone to bust ghosts, and they go and do that. This movie started out with Kristen Wiig working at a college at Columbia, and she gets kicked out because she believes in ghosts. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, they're saying, you know, against the man, sort of a little bit of Die Hard in there. Then they, you know, did even more Die Hard, where the government was against them and two agents came in there and told them they couldn't do it. But then the end of the movie, the way they gain validity is the government says that they will fund them secretly. And that's how they move into the fire station and everything. So the whole movie was like, oh, the government doesn't like us. They're covering it up. Nobody believes us. And then they gain their legitimacy at the end because the government will secretly fund them. What does that say about today's day and age? That they've taken this movie that was about free markets and businessmen and turned it into that.
Yeah, it's yeah. Pretty sad.
Because I was waiting. I was like, that's the one redeeming thing. And then they fucking cut the legs out from under it at the end. I was like, so you shit on me even more here. I was kind of trying to be sympathetic to you, and then you did that.
Bald Brian, the Adam Carolla's co-host or sidekick. Or...
If he liked the movie, I'm going to just write him
off.
No,
he did not like the movie at all. Okay. Thought it was a terrible movie.
Okay, good.
But he said, this is actually an astute point that he made, which is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, quote unquote, disliking this movie is misogyny or whatever.
I have not mentioned gender once, have I?
No. But
okay, I'd like to make that point.
The pure fact of misliking this movie is apparently misogyny. But he said, I don't think he said this directly, but this is what he said, sort of paraphrase him. There was so little connection between this movie and the franchise. In fact, there was zero connection between this movie and the franchise other than they called it Ghostbusters and they fought ghosts. That is actually kind of misogynistic that you had to make this movie as a Ghostbusters movie. Why couldn't you just make a cool movie about four funny women who kick ass and fight evil spirits? Like, why did you have to make it a Ghostbusters movie? Because you didn't think these women would sell otherwise, and that's the misogynistic part.
Yeah, I think this whole movie was the whole Ghostbusters franchise was just a vehicle to sell the movie.
Yes.
I think there was nothing in the movie that made this a movie, a Ghostbusters movie.
Yes, it was just, right, like exactly. You said, they were just, you know, William, you said to me on the phone, because I had to call somebody and rant after I saw it, you said to me this was just them trying to print money, basically.
Yeah, that's all this was. It was a cash grab, and it's unfortunate because this could have been a reboot worthwhile, and what I mean by that is, if Sony really wanted to start another series of sequels, I mean, everybody's making sequels of everything, this could have been a really good sequel. I mean, you could think up of you could do a complete reboot if you wanted. You could do a the Ghostbusters of franchise sort of like continuation. There's tons of things that you could have done that would have made it a really interesting interesting movie, but then also give Sony that chance to make another movie. I don't know how anyone at Sony thinks that someone's going to want to go see a sequel of this.
Well, like it's the Netflix model. So they said, okay, Ghostbusters is a hit franchise. Franchises are selling well right now. And Paul Feig and his women comedy movies are doing well right now. Oh, if we mash those up, those will sell. That's the same thing Netflix does where they look at the statistics. Oh, people love Kevin Spacey. They love political thrillers and they love adaptation of British shows. Oh, let's put Kevin Spacey in an adaptation of House of Cards. It's that same mentality.
Do you think that this movie suffered because Feig wasn't given the R rating on this movie? Do you think it would have been better?
No.
An R-rated movie?
I think it suffered because I don't think he's that talented. I think the talent that's come before with him was, one, he did Freaks and Geeks with Judd Apatow, and then I think everything he's done since, he capitalized on the star power that he was given. If you look at a movie like Bridesmaids or, you know, any of these other movies he's done with these women, they carried it with their ad-libbing and everything. And if you look at the movie, they try to ad-lib and they try to work with it, but when you're not even given a character to work with, there's nothing you can do. If there's one reason to see this movie, it's to see Kate McKinnon try her hardest to create a character out of being given nothing. Just watching what she does from purely a performer standpoint with her character, which is sort of like the engineer Egon type character, I admired her effort. I wanted to be like, just give all my money for my ticket to her, because that woman is trying so hard to make something out of the nothing she was given. But this comes from somebody just having no talent and being given this kind of a budget. I mean, when I was watching it, I was sitting here, I was going, how can anyone ever talk shit about Zack Snyder? You want to talk about a CGI mess? Look at the third act of this movie. No, there's nothing that could have been done to redeem this, short of having a different writer write it. That's what it could have been done. And also, I think the original Ghostbusters works because it's, even though it's a comedy, they remember that comedy, good comedy comes from drama.
Yeah. And there's true horror elements, not in the that sort of too. Gory sense, but there's true horror elements in the original Ghostbusters. And one of the, from all the reviews and from talking to you, it sounds like that none of that is, there's no scary parts in this Ghostbusters.
No, not at all. There's no scary, there's no dramatic. There's attempts at putting characters in situations or putting actors in situations to attempt to have them ad lib. And that's what it felt like. It felt more like I was watching Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, Leslie Parker. It felt more like I was watching them try to ad lib and come up with funny punchlines than it felt like I was watching a movie with characters. All right, so let's take down some trailers here.
Nice.
We don't have the sound effect yet. I'm still working on it in my head, but we do have a concept now. So thanks.
Trailer takedown.
Yes. Sorry. Something like that is what I'm going to go for. Yes. But thanks to Midsider Michael last week, you have to say whether you would tackle this movie to take it down or hug it to take it down. So
if that's Midsider Michael's lasting legacy, you need to whitewash history here. Goodness gracious.
You would want to whitewash history, wouldn't you, you racist?
Yeah, he's only half racist.
Half Mexican?
Yes. Yeah, he's only half racist.
Half self-hating racist. Okay, so really quickly here, let's bust through each of these trailers. The first trailer is La La Land. Would you tackle or hug this trailer?
I'm going to hug this one. It looked interesting. It looks a little weird, but like it looked interesting. And I like it, the music was cool. So I have no real idea what the plot is going to be just from this preview, but you know, it looked kind of interesting, and I think I'm gonna give it a gentlemanly pat on the back.
Daniel,
well, I'm hugging Emma Stone to the ground. but
I don't get the Emma Stone thing.
Okay, you're clearly closeted. Okay, so this trailer looks interesting. I liked the music a lot. William alluded to the good music. But then the end starts to take this sort of fantastical bit that looks almost like magical realism. And I was in. I thought this looks like a movie that could actually use, you know, magical realism or fantastical realism in a very interesting way. So I'm in.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction to you, Daniel. I went from tackle to hug. And it started out, it was like, Emma Stone, Ryan Gosling, La La Land, which is what people call L.A. It looked like a boring rom-com. And then it turned. And it turned when it said, from the writer-director of Whiplash. And I was like, And then all of a sudden it became this magical realist thing. And I was like, all right, I'm in. This is different. This is unique. I want to see where this goes. And because it's by this guy, it's probably going to be pretty smart.
Yeah, I'm in.
Enough said. Let's watch it.
Next trailer.
What's it called again?
It's called La La Land by the writer-director of Whiplash. I don't know when it's out yet, though. This was just the teaser trailer, so we'll learn more about it, and we'll talk more about it in coming episodes. Next trailer is called Loving, and this movie is about Loving v. I don't remember what was it. Who was it against? It wasn't Brown versus Board of Education. It was Loving v. what? This is about the black and white couple that fought the legal system for the right to marry, because they got married and then they were told they weren't actually legally married because they weren't allowed to marry because he was white and she was black.
Yep. It's on the tip of my tongue. Loving people. Oh, it's Virginia.
I was going to say that.
1967 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Loving v. Virginia.
Yes. It's about that.
I'm tackling this one. It didn't. that didn't look interesting to me. Maybe it's just not a subject I'm particularly interested in, but these kinds of like historical reenactment movie sort of things, like just as a genre, it's harder for me to get into, but it didn't really look that, it looked very preachy, and I was, I kind of struggled to watch the whole thing.
The Ruxin from the League plays their lawyer.
Yeah, that's where they lost me too, because it's a black girl and a white guy together, and I just pictured him yelling "Forever Unclean," and I was like, that's really bad, Justin. Get that out of your head. They come into his office. We need to sue to be married. Forever Unclean!
Yeah, all that being said, I'm going to wait for another trailer. Like, this was a trailer that's clearly trying to get the preachy part out of the movie into a trailer, and I don't know. I am sort of interested in the subject matter, so, you know, we'll see. If it ends up being... If all the trailers look preachy, I'm definitely tackling it to the ground. If a couple of them look decent, then I'm in. I need more of the courtroom stuff. That's what I need. I need the courtroom arguments. I'll watch To Kill a Mockingbird for the courtroom stuff. I'll watch fucking what was that movie? The Grisham book.
The Stand.
Grisham, Justin. That's Stephen King.
Pet Sematary.
No, what was the Grisham movie? Not To Kill a Mockingbird. It was like that. That was about the black guy who killed the white rapists of his
daughter. Green Mile.
Oh my god! People are terrible. We're terrible at American literature. All right, moving on. This is a maybe hug movie. Maybe.
Which is funny because you're always shitting on all these movies. This is a major tackle for me. This is just pure social awareness movie. I looked at this director and he hasn't really gotten any notoriety for anything he's done. So I think he was like, oh, I'll make a social awareness picture and everyone will love me then. I would not be surprised to see this nominated for Oscars. The girl who plays the black woman played Reyna on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I wouldn't be surprised if this movie sort of turned her into a star. So... I think a lot of people will love this, but I think it's ultimately crap. Next trailer. It's called White Girl, and it is about a white girl, and it is about cocaine.
No.
I tackled this one, too. I don't know that I can say anything interesting about the trailer.
There's one thing to say about this trailer. If you want evidence of what naturalism in film looks like,
yes.
Watch this trailer. And that's the only reason I included it in the outline, is because the trailer's all like, oh, this is a great debut film by this director and blah, blah, blah. No, this is just pure naturalism.
Yeah, like, I was kind of wondering why this was in there, because I was like, this doesn't, it's, there's nothing of, there's no style here.
It's, oh, God, it's so horrible looking. Look, fuckers, if you want to see junkies having sex, it's porn. Just go watch porn. Why make it a movie?
Or downtown LA. You can go, there's definitely some areas down in LA that you can check that out if you want.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was a TV show at one point called Bum Fights. So just watch that.
There you go.
This looks like it's such a shitty movie. A Time to Kill. That's the fucking name.
Oh. That's not the one I was thinking of.
Slash movie. Matthew McConaughey and Samuel L. Jackson, bitches. Great courtroom drama movie.
Okay. So let's talk about some news real quick. We're just going to talk about one story for the sake of time. This story works perfectly when we're talking about the Ghostbusters movie, because it also has to do with a movie dealing with a powerful woman in an action sequence, but it deals with it from the opposite role. This story is from The Verge, and it's called Three Men Wrote Wonder Woman, and That's a Problem. They are cursed Did you say no, it's not?
I did. It's not.
You're spoiling our take on the story, Daniel!
Go ahead.
I can't. I haven't even written on my whiteboard right now. I'm holding it in my lap. And they're referring to the fact that Geoff Johns I can't remember the other guy's name because I don't have it in front of me. Heinberg is his last name. And, of course, Zack Snyder all wrote the story, and then Johns and Heinberg wrote the script for Wonder Woman. And there were a few choice quotes I want to pull out of this article, which I think just completely undermine and destroy this article. So the first one. Johns and Heinberg both worked on the script, and they've each written Wonder Woman stories before for DC Comics. Johns, who's already DC's chief creative officer, was brought on earlier this year to oversee the entire DC movie slate, largely because of his talent. Heinberg, meanwhile, has already written for a number of popular TV shows, including Sex and the City and Scandal, and was executive producer for the CW's aborted Wonder Woman project.
Do they have to use the word aborted?
I'm sure they did that on purpose. But if you're going to try and say these people aren't worthy of writing this, why would you put this stuff in there? I mean, Heinberg wrote for Sex and the City, and he writes for Scandal?
Ridiculous.
So basically you're not supposed to pick the most qualified writers or directors or producers, right? That's what we're advocating here.
Oh, we're not even just advocating that. Ready for the next quote? It's important to note here that next year's Wonder Woman doesn't lack for women with influence behind the camera. Director Patty Jenkins is at the helm. Deborah Snyder and Rebecca Rovin are both on board as producer and executive producer, respectively. A veritable murderer's row of talented women have worked in casting, production design, art direction, and music for the film. But that's still not enough.
Why is that not enough?
Yeah, I was going to say, what would be enough? I'm curious now. You've got me intrigued.
They never answer that question, and that's the problem. This is the final quote. When a film story is about a powerful woman surrounded by powerful women, that story demands some input from at least one person who knows what it's like to be a woman. That kind of contribution could have only added to the film.
So Caitlyn Jenner should be the executive producer.
I mean, that's what it sounds like, right? Like, maybe Chris Pine should have been Caitlyn Jenner instead, so all the men in the movie can be transitioning or something.
I mean, is this the modern segregation that we really want? Movies about women can only be made by women. Movies about black people can only be made by black people. Movies about gay people can only be made by gay people. Is that honestly what the left thinks would be a utopia? Is that what they want? To completely go back to an era when everything was segregated?
Well, what I want to know is, since I'm male, am I allowed to watch this movie? Will they be checking IDs on the way in? Will it be offensive? Is it misogynistic for me to be excited about a Wonder Woman movie?
I think it's misogynistic for you to comment on the movie. I think you can see it, but you have no right to comment on it because you don't know what it's like to be a woman.
They'd prefer if you didn't see it, though. If you could just drop your money off at the door and then leave that seat for someone with a vagina,
yeah.
I think really that's what they'd prefer.
If you pay for women to see the movie.
They should pay for women to see it.
Right.
Yeah, I get it.
No, here's the funny thing about this, right? They're saying, like, they need a woman's voice. I think, do they not understand what a director does, or are they just, like, ignoring that fact to make their point? Because do you really think if, like, there was something in the script that didn't make sense from a female point of view, that Patty Jenkins would just be like, yeah, it's okay. You know, it's okay that you guys gave Wonder Woman a penis. You know, that makes total sense. You don't think she'd be like, no, she's supposed to have a vagina. That's how that works.
Now, Justin, genitalia does not a woman make.
That's right.
I understand that. But you get the point I'm making, right? Not to mention, in our Sucker Punch episode, didn't we discuss extensively how Zack Snyder went to long efforts to give the actresses he had the freedom to play it in a feminine way? Like, he talked specifically about the one scene where they all start crying at the end, and he said, I never could have written that, and I never would have told them not to do it, but it was an amazing moment because they just cried and it worked because they were playing it in the most feminine way they thought possible. They just did what worked for them.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So do they really think that these... I mean, that's the thing, is it's again, coming from this perspective that men can't possibly not only understand women, but they can't possibly respect women. As if Johns and Heinberg and Snyder are going to be like, no, you can't do it that way. This is how we wrote it. I mean, do you really think Snyder's going to not listen to his wife? Like, is that how this works? Like, Snyder's like, walk 10 paces behind me the whole time they're producing and everything?
I think that there's going to be a lot of continued controversy around Wonder Woman because Wonder Woman isn't even liked by the hardcore feminists. You know, like there's some that do, there's some that don't. They're all over the place. Like this is touching on a subject that's kind of a touchstone for a lot of like quote unquote women's issues. And I think that what's going to come out of this, you know, knowing the kind of the quality that Snyder produces, it's going to be wonderful. And it's not going to have enough social justice-y stuff to make them happy. And that's going to be the final, you know, critique of this movie. It's not, they're not even going to look at it as a movie. They're going to look at it as what is it, how does it fit into the social justice narrative? And he's not, you know, in that narrative, he's not going to win no matter what. Wouldn't matter how many female producers there would be on the show or on the movie. They're not going to be satisfied. And so I don't think criticisms like this even matter.
No, they don't. But it's important to talk about. And they're not going to like how the movie ends because the movie's set in World War I, so well before Batman versus Superman. And odds are the movie is going to end with her exiling herself. And this is going to be the story to explain why Wonder Woman has been in hiding all these years. And, you know, nobody's going to like that because she's obligated to save the world with her powers. My guess would be she cares so deeply and the world spurns her that she's like, why should I open myself up to caring so deeply when I only get hurt? And it's going to be a statement on, you know, femininity and how, you know, women feel like they can't care for the world because they're just hurt by it. In the same way that Superman felt like he can't protect the world because he was just hurt by it. So it'll be the cognate to Batman versus Superman in a way. That would be my guess.
Good guess. We shall see.
We'll see. But for now, let's move on to people with even greater problems. It's time for Reddit on Reddit. Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way. EA blows, Steam rocks, got risk for my Firefox. See, these things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it. First Reddit. I'm an 18-year-old, it doesn't say 18-year-old, just says 18. I'm an 18 high school graduate, which I don't know how you get to level 18 high school graduate. But.
My high school only went to 12th grade. But
yeah.
All right.
And I'm being kicked out of my parents' home, have 300, is that the pound symbol?
I think that's a euro.
That's a maybe. Euro? Well, yeah. So he has about a dollar, 300 euro in my bank account, and no idea how to survive in the real world. And this guy had a long post and blah, blah, blah. But basically, he's looking for advice as to what he should do next.
Yeah, I mean, part of the context here is he says basic things like, it's hard for me to find a job. I have no skills. I've been to places. They tell me, look, you're screwed. So what should he do? This is one of the things where, you know, it's like, okay, so first of all, you have no other family. That would be the first place to check. He says he claims that he has no other family except an aunt who won't return his calls. That's the only other family you have. You don't have any grandparents. You don't have any siblings. You don't have any other aunts and uncles. You don't have any other distant cousins that you knew growing up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can ask them for a place to live or some help or something. You can't expect it, but that's something to do. And then secondary tier, and probably the tier that should be the greatest at this point in his life, friends. Do your friends have couches you could crash on, their family homes? Are they going to colleges where you could crash on the dorm floor for a little while you're getting things set up like a job and whatnot? Like, where is this guy's personal network of people that he has had 18 years to build relationships with? That's my first question. Why exploit the hell out of that personal network if you have it?
Well, don't exploit it. That's a...
You know what I mean.
Yeah, just wanted to be clear about the usage of the word. Because if James were here, he would jump all over you for that.
No, yeah. I wouldn't. I'm using it correctly.
The other thing to do, too, is to get a job. And this isn't, you know, I'm going to sound super callous here, but this isn't hard. There's tons of people that will take you. If you show up to work on time, if you put in the effort, they will hire you, even if it's just a day labor kind of job. any work experience leads to more work experience. It's not, you know, I don't know where this guy's applying for a job, but, you know, and I know it's probably somewhere in Europe, so they can't fire anyone. So they are really, you know, hiring someone is a risky endeavor. But even finding some sort of temporary work doing anything, or even just volunteering to get some experience doing something, that is has a huge snowball effect. I mean, one of the things I've been reading up on recently is there's apparently a whole class of people now that are like in their 30s living in their parents' basement because they never got any work experience, and now they're you know declaring themselves a victim of not being able to find a job because they're unemployable. They're some sort of victim, and you know these things can be corrected. I'm not saying it's easy, as in it's just oh you're just gonna start doing it, it's gonna be great. You know, you have to find your own way, and part of finding your own way is trying a bunch of jobs and getting that experience, even if it's not something you like. You're getting a base that you can build on, and that's the hard work of life is to put in that time building that base in your life.
Yes, do anything to emphasize William's point. Do anything
except
and do it
read
the
Reddit.
Best of your ability.
Except get off Reddit and go out into the real world and not Pokemon Go.
Do it
not Reddit
as well as you can possibly do it. And even if you don't have skills, like to just hammer home what William was saying, it is not a skill that you have to learn to show up on time. It is not a skill you have to learn to pay attention. It's not a skill you have to learn to do what you're told when your boss asks you. These are things you got out of the box, as they say. Do those things and you will already stand out. And, you know, try to exploit your network in order to find a place to live so you don't have to live on the street. By the way, definition of exploit: make full use of and derive benefit from. Exploit.
Good. I'm glad you explained it. You made my point for me. I just wanted you to explain it because most people would be like, don't take advantage of people, you selfish prick. I think a point needs to be made here that is a very Adam Carolla-esque point. And you sort of made it when you said do anything at this point. If you have 300 euro, which is like a dollar, in the bank.
It's not. I'm going to look up the exchange rate.
Please do. I'm just making fun of Europe at this point. And you're 18 and all you have is your high school diploma and you have nowhere to live. This is an issue of survival. And I say that this is an Adam Carolla point because he always talks about how people want to be fulfilled by their careers. And they have this idea that what you're doing at work every day should be fulfilling, that it's they have an obligation, the employer has an obligation to give you fulfillment. No. When you're starting from the bare minimum of living on the streets, the first thing is survival. Everything after that is built upon survival. And people need to realize that. Even when you make, you know, say you make $200,000 a year, your first X amount still has to go to your survival. Whatever your income is, you always have to deduct, what is my survival cost? I'm talking about how do I get fed? How do I find a place to lay my head down safely and take a shit safely? How do I get to where I need to go safely? Only once you do that do you have a disposable income. Everyone does not automatically have a disposable income. But in today's day and age, when you've been living with your parents, you think everything is a disposable income, and it's not.
Right. Indeed. You do what you have to in order to survive.
And then you do the other stuff. And that's part of the pride and the joy you get from being able to do the other stuff, because you realize, I've earned it. Otherwise, it's just what the world owes you, and you don't understand the hard work you've put in. I can look at the things I own with pride. I can look at my web series with pride because I earned that over my basic survival needs.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Part of my job managing people, the one thing that I always know someone's on a road towards failure when they come in and they have an entitlement sort of attitude and approach to work. Like, they're entitled to things at work, entitled to, you know, whether it's a pay raise or I've worked hard for a year. I can show up late every now and then now that I've put a year in. And it's like, no. Like, these are the things. these behaviors that you do, that does earn you something, but it's not earning you the right to, not show up to work on time or to more money than the company can pay you or things like that, right? You're not entitled to have disposable income because you put a year of solid work in, right? You know, those things, the benefits can come to you, but you've got to work at them. And right. Sometimes it's going to be a lot of work.
The late thing is them getting it backwards. You can earn the right for your boss to trust you and understand that if you are coming in late, it's for a specific, important, high-value reason. But that's different from, oh, I've proven I can show up on time if I need to, so I'm just going to start showing up late all the time. Those are two completely different things.
Yep.
All right.
So he should take his approximately $332 and put it toward his survival needs.
Right. So live on someone's couch and only spend those $332 on survival needs. That means if you need to eat 99-cent cheeseburgers at McDonald's every day until you get a job, you do that. Because you do not have the luxury right now.
Living like a king.
Well, yeah, that's the
99-cent cheeseburgers at McDonald's. Get a chub pack of Top Ramen for $1.86.
Right. You can even do that. Or you can put ketchup in water and call it tomato soup. That's one of my dad's favorite stories of what he had to do. He was so poor. I was so poor, I had to put ketchup in a bowl of water and call it tomato soup.
Not eating dinner at the Lesneski house.
Yeah, some days my dad is Red Foreman. Next Reddit. What is something that shocked you to learn how expensive it is? My answer to this question is Funko Pops. They tried to run me off of Reddit with a torch the other day because someone was posting about how he bid $14,000 on a rare Funko Pop. And I replied, do you realize you could invest that money and then buy lots more Pops? And everyone tried to attack me. They were like, why are you being negative? Blah, blah, blah. I just can't fathom. Like, even somebody today spent like $625 on three Pops. And I just can't fathom spending that kind of money on that. $14,000 to me is a new car. A nice new car.
Yeah, that's...
Nothing but the finest Kia for Justin.
Kia.
Well, no, you're going to do your car payments on top of it. But if you can put a $14,000 down payment down... You can get a pretty good car if you're then adding on your monthly payments.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, indeed. There are only sort of two rational reasons why you would put that amount of money into a Funko Pop. One is if you are a collectibles dealer and you have someone looking for this and you can make money, et cetera. Or two, if you have so much fucking disposable income that you have no idea what to do with it. And it's between that or shove it in your ears and light it on fire. Like, I just don't know why. It's a piece of plastic. I mean, yeah. I enjoy them. They're fun to collect. They're aesthetically pleasing. They're interesting. But $14,000 for that? There's no connection reality with what that's worth. That's insane.
Well, you know, I noticed on this Reddit that no one mentioned anything about starting a business. And I was going to tell you that it was shocking to me, even though I was slightly prepared going into it, all of the ridiculous permits and licensing and taxes. And I just had to pay my unsecured property tax.
Yeah.
What does that even mean? I had to look it up. All these things, paying for things that I'm getting no value for. There's a particular inspection certificate that I'm paying for the second time, and I've never actually gotten inspected, which I'm kind of happy for, but, you know, because I'm sure, like, not that I think they would find anything, but I'm sure it would be a hassle. But, you know.
Oh, they'd make something up.
Yeah, but I'm paying ostensibly to, you know, be inspected. And I still have not been inspected. So what am I paying for? What value am I getting out of this? None.
Yeah. William, I have the same experience with production. where people are like, oh, did you set up a LLC? Like, did you set up the Midside LLC or, you know, the Midside Films LLC? And I'm like, I don't want to pay $800 a year for nothing. Like, it's literally give the government $800 a year to simply say no one else can use that name ever.
Yeah.
I don't have that kind of disposable income.
Like that when I was... Gotta put that toward Pops. when I was owning my own business, I still do, I guess, but in L.A., and it's things like, oh, you know how to pay the L.A. business tax. It's like, wait, what? L.A. has its own personal... It's like, yeah, it's 5% of fucking gross, motherfucker. Yeah. Pay up. What? So there is that. That's a really good answer, William. My answer is not quite as good as that, and it's probably a little more obvious than that. But, well, first, I'll say that the first one on the Reddit, picture framing, absolutely. You ever try to get a picture framed? Jesus Christ, it's expensive. But that's not my answer.
Yeah, that's true.
My answer was wedding anything.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Now, I understand that people tell you weddings are expensive, and so just sort of like William with the business, I went into things thinking, oh yeah, weddings are getting expensive, but I'm going to keep the cost down. Fucking A. Anytime you put wedding in front of any goddamn thing, it becomes 70 times as expensive as the normal thing.
Again, that's my joke.
Like, we are looking at cakes. Cake. It's cake. Something you eat, and then within 24 hours, you shit it out. Cake. Two-tier cakes. Like, it's starting regular cakes, regular everyday ordinary two-tier cake starting at $70. Great, fantastic. When you call them and say it's for a wedding, oh, now they're starting at $800. $800 for cake.
Okay, so if I use this bit in a stand-up set, I don't want anyone to think I plagiarized it from Daniel, because this comes from a conversation we had.
Yes, indeed.
Well, my appearance fee for showing up to your wedding alone, you know, I'm like 10 times. So
I know. So, for instance, like, we didn't even get fucking cake at our wedding. People who went there, you might have noticed we only had pie. You know why? There's no such thing as wedding pie. So they don't jack up the fucking price of pie. This exact same cost whether you eat it at a T-ball game or your wedding.
Yeah. It's like anything is 10% more. And this is pretty much what you said. I'm just going to say it the way I had it in my head. It's, you know, you go to order a cake. You're like, can I have a cake? And they're like, sure. What do you want to have on it? Well, can you put a bride and groom on it? So this is a wedding cake? Oh, yeah, that'll be $700. Like,
yes. It's ludicrous.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What kind of business do you have? It's a wedding business, so we charge 20% more for everything. All right.
Exactly.
Last Reddit. I don't agree with save the children first mentality. It takes way less time to replace a 5-year-old kid than it does a 40-year-old. Now, I included this because we already sort of, over the last couple years of the podcast, blew up the idea of, you know, women first, right? We have this idea that women need to be saved before men, and we were kind of talking about that. Should we also agree with this guy about undermining the idea that children necessarily need to be saved first?
I'm going to say that children should be saved first. And the reason is children, especially like a 5-year-old, they're innocent and helpless in a way that an adult is not. And so I'm totally for, you know, helping children out of a burning building first, off a sinking ship, those sort of like scenarios. Absolutely. Children first, not necessarily in a sacrificial way, but in a benevolent universe sort of way. I'm not saying I'm going to run in and try to save a random child. But if my nephews and his friends are stuck in something, I'd risk my life to go in and try to help. There's an idea, if I was on a cruise ship that hit a reef in Italy, I would want to make sure that, you know, that the kids got even random kids that I met on the cruise ship, I would want to make sure they got taken care of.
Which seems to be all cruise ships lately.
Yeah. Not instead, but first.
All cruise ships hitting those reefs in Italy. It's ridiculous. A couple of things, piggybacking on what William said. In regards to the innocence thing, in most cases, children didn't choose to be wherever they are in trouble, whereas adults did. So that would be one bit of innocence thing you'd want to save them. Like on a cruise, it's not like a child was like, yeah, we're going on this fucking cruise, mom and dad, screw you, let's go.
What about the Disney cruise?
Yeah, it's a fair point.
What if One Direction holds a cruise?
In most cases, they're Justin, Captain Point Shitter. And then the other
I like
thing
that.
Is,
that's my superhero name, Captain Point Shitter.
Captain Point Shitter. There are a couple other things I have. So the second one is children just physically smaller, take up less room, can carry more of them. So like three children equals an adult. So that's, you know, compact and put them in compartments. And then the third one is, I think there's a bit of context dropping for this question, which is not that it's sort of some mystical a priori save children first. It's in the scenarios where the children are in danger, it's that the parents want their children to be saved first. Like in most cases, the parents are saying, please save my children first before me. That's because the parents value their children's lives and they want them to grow up and be productive, happy, healthy citizens, whereas they've lived the adults have lived a huge percentage of their life. So those are my three things. Are you going to be the contrarian here, Justin, and say that fuck children?
Well, I'm not going to say fuck children. Like, I don't want to end up on any like Megan's list or whatever the fuck that shit is.
I don't want to go Hanson to show up and ask you to take a seat.
Yeah, I don't want to like show up looking for brownies and lemonade and end up with Chris Hansen. No, I just think the one point that should be made, the caveat is like, if you have to choose between saving children and like the one surgeon who's going to save the world, like obviously you want to keep the one surgeon who's going to save the world because he's going to save the world and a 5-year-old can't do that. I think that's the one point they're trying to make.
That it's contextual, is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, no, I agree with you, it's contextual. I'm just giving context to make some sort of contrary point here. All right, well, let's put a bow in this episode, all right?
All right.
What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
Well, I learned the very specific and nuanced, yet important point that it was Jarvis and not Tony Stark who initiated the phone call with Pepper Potts. And Tony Stark is more like, eh, fuck you, whatever. Okay.
And just like a bitch, she didn't even answer the phone. The man she loves is about to die, and she didn't even fucking answer the phone. Because she was too busy watching television.
Indeed.
These hoes, man, these hoes. William?
Well, I learned that because the FBI did not have a gay agent in the investigative team, they were unable to determine whether the terrorists targeted the Pulse nightclub because it was a gay club.
Indeed. Need more FBI gays.
Yeah.
Start applying. Justin, what'd you learn?
I learned that my superhero name is Captain Point Shitter, but I don't know if that means that I shit on other people's points or that my shit is really pointy.
Point Shitter? You mean one who shits points?
Yeah, like I shit out points.
Yeah. I really feel really bad at this point for any of the Metaside viewers. You don't want to see the tag to this episode on the Metaside.
Well, if you learned something, whether from the news or about yourself, you can tell us at twitter.com/themidside or on facebook.com/themidside or that horrible thing that children do called the Snapchats. At the Midside.
Yeah, there. If you want to see me not fat shame people on my Snapchat, add me.
You too can watch Justin play Pokemon.
I did do that. I was wandering around shirtless in the middle of the night playing Pokemon.
Oh God. Oh, and then of course you can go to the website, which is themidside.com/podcast. Or here's the three major actions you can take this week to be a star Midsider. One, if you haven't already, and we know many of you have because you're fantastic, but if you haven't, you can go to iTunes, type in Midside into the little search bar, and then you can find us, and then you can give us a 5-star rating. 5 of them. All 5. It's like a constellation of stars. And you can tell us why. Even if you fucking hate us, you can tell us why, but still give us the 5 stars. Thank you. Two, patreon.com/themidside. There you can go and you can actually give us money. Like, like something that used to be backed by some currency, but which is now fiat, you can give it to us and we'll accept it because we're not libertarian. If we could take Bitcoin, though, we would, because then we would be libertarian. We would not turn down Bitcoin.
I'll set that up for you guys if you want. We'll set up a Bitcoin.
Oh my God, William! I would love you forever if we could accept Bitcoin.
I'll get on it.
You heard it here first. Okay, so you can go to patreon.com/midside. You can choose to give us money every time we deliver content. Not money just randomly or money for no reason, but money every time we deliver you content. We have Patreon subscribers now who are giving us actual money. It's fantastic. It helps us keep the lights on over here. Helps us advertise. And then finally, the third thing I said you could do to be a super midsider this week, tell someone.
Yeah, that's the number one thing.
I know you're all out there playing Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
Running into strangers. When you meet a stranger on the street, you say, hey, you like Pokemon Go. I like Pokemon Go. You know what I like? The Midside Podcast. I bet you'll like it too. And then you'll be arrested for sexual harassment, but it'll be worth it. Because we'll be more popular. Thanks, folks. See you next time.
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this trip. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Hello?
I think it worked. It's calling William, I believe. Yep.
Hello.
Hey, look at that. It worked.
Oh, my God. I hate this shitty software.
Hey, hey, did you try turning it on and off again, Daniel?
Oh, my God. I hate Skype.